came about, how it was written, and these sorts of things. And the second is the book, A History of the Bible. Now, while this has some information about its composition and evolution as a piece of literature, it basically describes all the Bible's various editions of the Bible. From, for example, the Vulgate Bible of Jerome, the Gutenberg Bible, the St. James Bible, the Bible of Native Americans, Mormons, so those sorts of things. So it's two different types of books. And it was overpowering. I thought, how in the world can you tie such a subject like this together? You know, it. Have you ever been, you know, wanting to do something and do a good job, and you're almost intimidated before you begin by saying, how in the world am I going to put this together? And I finally concluded that if all of you were charged with doing the same topic, we would probably have as many versions of that as there are people in this room today. But what do you think of when you hear the word the Bible? God's Word. Sacred literature. But would you not agree that it is something that probably, while in the main we have collective and common beliefs, we all probably have some that are very particular to ourselves? And I suspect, let me just play a little game here for a moment. Now pretend that you've really messed up with your spouse and you're going to be exiled to a deserted island for a year. Frank, is that already happened? I saw that hand go up. Now, what books would you carry with you? Let's say, what would be your first and second choices? You've got to choose at least two to carry with you. Now, what two books would you carry? What's the first one you think you would carry? Most of you would say the Bible. I already knew that. What I'm interested in is what's the second book you're going to carry with you? Now we get into an interesting set of choices there. The Bible is something that brings us together. And yet, as we look at it in our particular insights and circumstances, can potentially divide us, can it not? But it is something central. Can you conceive of us operating as we do without an essentially agreed-upon set of religious literature? Because it is a guide that we turn to again and again. And yet, I think that we're never, ever, you know, we're not taught how to read it and comprehend it and interpret it in a common fashion. We each have an individual experience. We may have grown up in a home in which the Bible, if we had one, was on a shelf and it collected dust because it was rarely opened. Or it may be that you were reared in a home in which something was read from it every day, or on a very regular basis. And sometimes in dealing with the Bible, people don't let their imaginations run or ask questions that they would do about any other book, because they feel like, I can't go there. This is the sacred literature. Now, God didn't create the Bible. He didn't write it. Man did. And when we use the word Bible, it is a book. But in other ways, the Bible can mean other things too. Now, I'm trying to get a talk started this morning, and I want to read two passages from the two books I held up. The first one is from Stephen Miller and Robert Huber's The Bible, A History, The Making and Impact of the Bible. On the brink of execution, the Apostle Paul wrote what many believe is his last surviving letter. He addressed it to his close friend Timothy, leader of a church in what is now Turkey. All Scripture is inspired by God, Paul wrote, and is useful for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness. The jailed apostle was talking about Jewish scripture, which Christians today call the Old Testament. Little did he know that one day Christians would consider his private letter part of sacred scripture. Paul was probably no exception in this regard. As far as scholars can tell, none of the biblical writers knew their words would become one day part of the Holy Bible. Yet in time, people of faith came to recognize the Word of God in these laws, history, poetry, wise sayings, prophecy, gospels, and letter. How people came to this awareness remains a mystery. We do know that not all Jews agreed on which writings belonged in their Bible, and that Christians debated what to include in the New Testament. It was not until the late AD 300s that the majority of church leaders ruled in favor of the collection of writings that make up the Bible today. Yet even now there is disagreement. Roman Catholics have an enlarged Old Testament, which includes several books and parts of books found in the Septuagint, the ancient Greek manuscript of Hebrew scriptures. Eastern Orthodox churches add a few more. No matter which collection of scriptures is studied, there is an astonishing consistency in these books that they were written by countless authors over a stretch of more than 1,000 years. The unifying element is God, His character, and His continuing plan of salvation, a strategy for reaching out to people and saving them from sin and the harm it causes. Even the Old Testament and New Testament writings compiled by the different theological camps of Jews and Christians unite in the seamless story of who God is and what He is doing to help humanity. That's how these authors open. Let's look at the concluding sentences of how this author closed his book, because in a way they address much that is the same. Both the Dead Sea Scrolls and the early Christian papyri from Egyptian deserts tell almost the same story. Both the Old and the New Testaments initially circulated in a variety of versions and in the company of many texts which might, in different circumstances, have become parts of the Bible. The books which we now regard as authentically biblical were sifted after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD and after the conversion of the Roman Empire to Christianity. It became necessary to endorse them as canonical. They have been preserved and disseminated ever since, more or less exactly, more widely than any other text ever written. They have become the Bible. They are now a single book. Many fundamental questions about the actual origins of the text are still matters of faith or limitless scholarly conjecture. Archaeology since Darwin, however, has taught us a great deal about the evolution of the Bible. It has given us real manuscripts. It has filled out the libraries of early Christianity and has given us a prehistory. Now, sometimes when we hear the name Darwin today, we automatically think of evolution and all kinds of notions that are still controversial in all kinds of contexts. But it spurred a search for records. The 19th century is not only the century in which the biological sciences are started to a great degree, but it is a period of significant early archaeology that has resulted in the acquisition of many artifacts that support the Bible, that provide a better understanding. Now, in the beginning, there were no written languages. But the spoken word was powerful. The Genesis creation relates that God said, "Let there be," and things were created. However, a great deal of time will pass before ancient Hebrews or Israelites, or even if by this time we want to call them Jews, will be able to read a written account of creation. The creation of not only the universe and world, but mankind. God's people, however, knew about creation. They knew about their history and the relationship with God and what we might collectively call their religious beliefs, because like all cultures everywhere in every early period of time, there is a lengthy period in which sages and others absorb so much of their culture, beliefs, and history, and pass it on by word of mouth. Men and women who had the ability, and they were trained, kept within their minds and could sit down and talk for hours, even days, relating their collective past. That's the only way they had to preserve it. Whether you're talking about the ancient Celtic civilization, whether you're talking about the Hebrews, whether you're talking about the Cherokees of East Tennessee and Western North Carolina. Now, the first writing system is generally believed to have developed in Mesopotamia, what is now the area of Iraq, at approximately 3200 BCE. Using a stylus, one could scratch into the face of a wet clay tablet certain signs and characters and lines that represented objects, sounds. Then, through this very primitive form, not truly a writing system as we would define it, but through this emerging written form of communication, they scratch something in essence into that tablet. They allow it to dry, and they can last for thousands of years under certain circumstances that are not broken or destroyed by bomb blast or roadside improvised devices or whatnot. And if you came to understand the symbols, you could figure it out. However, it took so many of these symbols as time passed, these Babylonians developed thousands of them, and it became so complex that very few could read them. Only kind of a scholarly class or a class of sages, scribes, scholars, whatever. Now, in addition to being able to scratch these into a tablet, clay tablet, and allow it to dry, you could also chisel or cut them into stone monuments. They also could preserve them in a temporary fashion by taking a board and putting a side on it, very shallow side, like you could take, a 1 by 12, and then take a strip and nail around it, pour wax into it, and then you could let it dry almost, scratch your symbols in. But those were rather temporary because the heat of the time could, you know, of course, you could reheat it, smooth it out, and use it again. Now, cuneiform writing represents a giant step forward. Another giant step forward begins to occur at about the same time in ancient Egypt. And this is another system of pictograms. It is developed by the Egyptians. The Egyptians, like the ancient Sumerians or earliest Babylonians, will describe much that is occurring in their society that we even utilize today. But theirs is, I think, a more usable system in certain ways. A symbol denoting an object or a motion or an animal or a plant A single symbol we call a hieroglyph, and collectively we call it hieroglyphic writings. It too becomes more complex with time, and probably 700 or 800 characters develop. Now, given the nature of society, the vast divide between the rich and educated and the poor and the slaves in ancient Egyptian society as it evolved, the class who could read the hieroglyphic writings was very small too. Because even with only, let us say, 700 symbols as opposed to perhaps 4,000 or 5,000, that's a lot to deal with. These are very cumbersome systems. But the Egyptians are also, I think, significant because they created the first durable yet inexpensive material on which you could write. They make papyrus. Now, what is papyrus in its initial form? A reed, a plant. What's paper basically made out of today? Trees. Now, papyrus are plants that grow in the edges of the water in streams in and around the Mediterranean basin. The largest and best are found in the Nile Delta. What you do is to cut the plant. And those in the Nile grew to the largest size of any in the Mediterranean world, 10 to 15 feet tall, and about 2 to 3 inches at their base. You pull the clump of papyrus up. Then you cut the stalk into sections, about 10 to 12 inches. Then you cut or scrape off the outer surface and remove the damp pith, a cylindrical white pith, which with a knife you then sliced into thin strips, maybe a quarter to inch and a quarter wide, and you laid them on a clean, dry surface with the edges touching. You took the next strips once you had made the width, probably 12 inches or so, 14. Then the second set of strips you laid crosswise, vertical, then horizontal. Once that was done, you took a hammer or a mallet and you kind of gently pounded it to force these fibers to begin to mesh with one another. Then you lay it aside in the sun to dry. Now, by using a paste, you can take one white piece of paper you've made in essence and glue it to another. And you might put 20 or 30 of them together. And then by taking something that might resemble a stick or something more ornate, and later some very beautiful ones are developed, shaped somewhat like a rolling pin, you can begin to roll it from each end. So you create the scrolls. Okay, so you have paper now. Almost an inexhaustible supply because there is so much of this material. Now you need a pen and ink. Ink is made by mixing the sap of the cicada, acacia shrub, with soot, scraped from a lamp, a burned pot, or you can make red ink by taking iron oxide and mixing. You can make ink from burning bones and mixing the charcoal like powder. And you write on the papyrus more in a painting-like motion than what we would use today. You don't put your hand down on the white paper. You take the reed that you've kind of chewed in so that it has a lot of fibers. In other words, like a miniature paintbrush, a fine little artist's brush. Posing your hand, you kind of paint the hieroglyphic symbols. Now, this material is very durable under certain circumstances, but it can be made in a large volume. It is an important export product for Egypt, and it is so associated with the writings of the ancient world for a long, long time. Now, while these advancements of the hieroglyphics and the cuneiform are very significant, and there begins to emerge in certain areas kind of a literature, it's interesting to note that particularly in the ancient Sumer writings or ancient Babylon, there are stories very similar to those we find early in the Old Testament. In the epic poems they produce an epic poem of their creation. They create an epic poem that's very famous because it has an account of a great flood. It's called the Epic of Gilgamesh. Very similar to what we find in Genesis. But the real key to written communications will not come until some time after this. And it figures very prominently into the story of the Hebrews and the emergence of a Hebrew language and literature. And basically, the surviving literature of that period is the Old Testament. There are virtually no ancient Hebrew accounting records that have survived, and descriptions of military campaigns, or this, that, and the other than what we find in the Old Testament today. Now, we need an alphabet. It is believed by scholars that the first primitive alphabets began to emerge, interestingly enough, in Canaan. Probably in the late 16th century BC. And over a period of several hundred years evolved. It is really the Phoenicians who carry these early proto-alphabets to a more complete process. Now the Phoenicians... you know, when you teach the Phoenicians in a Western Civ course, the first thing you put to them is, oh, they developed the alphabet. Second, they're the first to circumnavigate Africa. Third, they're associated with the Purple Dye. They're great traders. They established Carthage, all those sorts of things. The Phoenicians were a great seafaring people. They were a part of that massive outpouring of pirates and raiders that began to come out of parts of Europe before ancient Greece, classical Greece, emerged. And they made their living by raiding and seizing. But some settled. And the Phoenicians settled in the eastern Mediterranean, not too far from Canaan. They probably threw their... And they became great international traders. They probably began to pick up on this early alphabet that is emerging there. And then they began to use it, and they're important because trade is not just about exchanging an ox hide for this. Trade is the conduit through which ideas, language, religion, so many things pass. Now, from about 1050 to 850 BC, the Phoenicians are very active in elevating this earliest alphabet to a more finished form. The Phoenician language, the Hebrew language, are interrelated, as well as the Aramaic language. They're all in the same language family. We call it the West Semitic language group. Now, let's talk briefly about the Hebrew alphabet that is emerging that will enable the Hebrews to eventually begin to write. It consists of 22 letters. They are all consonants. Technically, it's not a true alphabet. It's what's called an abjad. That is an alphabet that does not have vowels. So in the earliest forms, they would write in all consonants, and those who could read as they read what was written, they had to supply the appropriate vowel or vowels dependent upon the context of what is being written. Like, take the words vacation and vocation. If you take the vowels out, the consonants are the same, are they not? So as you're reading something, you have to. Now, that's cumbersome, but it's still a great step forward. Now, the books of the Old Testament were written ultimately in Hebrew, with a few exceptions. There are a few chapters and some verses that were obviously translated out of other languages. And they were written over a period of about a millennium. Yes?
When did the Greek alphabet come into play?
The Greek alphabet is evolving. It's beginning to come about at approximately the same time in the 700s BCE. Now, the Greeks, of course, their big advantage is bringing the vowels into play. Now, in looking at the Old Testament that begins eventually to emerge in a written form, it depicts events the Old Testament wasn't, the books of the Old Testament weren't necessarily written at the same time that the events depicted were occurring, sometimes much later. And they are heavily indebted to the oral tradition that evolved from the very beginning in their society. But as it begins to emerge, one thing we can note that is unique about the ancient Hebrew is that the language remained very consistent despite kind of tweaking it from time to time, to the point that it ultimately became what is often referred to as a dead language. Now, many of you may have taken Latin somewhere back in your educational experience, and a lot of times we talk about, well, Latin is a dead language, you know. Basically, all that means is that Latin is still used, but classical Latin is not the everyday language of people. As the Hebrew language evolved, and as it began to be used for various purposes, to create a literature, to preserve records, to tell their story, vast historic changes, we shall note, occurred to the Hebrew people. And among those changes is that, you know, as you read the Old Testament, that almost a reoccurring cycle of God's people being saved from something or told about their relationship, but for long they mess it up somehow. You know, it's just, you know, it's amazing how many times they mess up and yet God forgives them, goes on, and all of that. But ultimately, that's going to stop to a great degree. with first the Assyrians and then later the Neo-Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar carrying them into captivity, which they were held there until the Persians defeated the Neo-Babylonian Empire and allowed them to go home. Given the complexity and actions of the Persian Empire, progressively, these people began to drop the use of Hebrew as their everyday form of communication and to adopt what the Persians used, the Aramaic language, a related language. Remember I said Hebrew, Phoenician, Aramaic, they're all interrelated. So, as the books begin to be written in the emerging Hebrew script, I'll note in a little while, the Hebrew language began to become the revered language, the language of their religion, the language of their priest more and more. And ultimately, by the time of Christ, we say the language he probably spoke in was what? Aramaic, Conan Greek, or street Greek. That's not to say perhaps that he did not know Hebrew. He very well could have. He had studied the scriptures. But here are some things that are occurring. Now, having said all these things, let's kind of begin to move into the composition or the evolution, the story of how the literature of the Old Testament began. Now, exactly when the ancient Hebrews began to write and to create what we call the Old Testament is somewhat shrouded in mystery. There are different ideas and different interpretations. The first person identified specifically in the Bible as a writer was Moses. And traditionally, we say that the first five books of the Old Testament were written by Moses. But we'll look at that a little more closely later. But to the identification. In the 17th chapter of Exodus, verses 8 through 14, there is a battle described. A battle between the Israelites led by Joshua and the Amalekites. Now, during the course of this battle, Moses did what? He went up to a hill or mountain overlooking the battle. And he held up his arms. And as long as he held up his arms, the forces of Joshua prevailed, did they not? But as he grew tired and his arms began to decline, what happened? The Amalekites began to win. But ultimately, by propping his arms up and others came and held them, Joshua won. Now, after Joshua had won, we are told in verse 14, quote, "Then the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven," end of quote. Now, kind of keep this in mind. Here we have Moses identified as a writer. Let's move to the giving of the Ten Commandments. This incident, of course, deeply involves Moses. After delivering the Ten Commandments that God had written out on the stones that Moses had made for this purpose, Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 6 through 7, quote, "These commandments I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up." Now, I'm stressing this because he said, do what with them? Talk about them. Tell your children. Trying to emphasize the evolution, and this is so key, the oral tradition, the God ordered, if you will, to pass what you know, to pass our experiences, father to son. Now, in this era, our forebearers here, religiously, more so than physically, but this is characteristics of all early. You don't have an educational system. Those aren't going to come around generally available to everyone until modern history. The French are more responsible than anyone else for creating a state public education system. It is the responsibility of whom to teach the children occupations, crafts, trades. It is the father's duty. It's the mother's duty. And not only to how to plow or how to be a blacksmith or a coppersmith or something else, but to particularly, not only the father, but the priestly group that has evolved, their responsibility is to teach where did we come from, what have we done, what are our values, what are our beliefs. You know, tragically today, for those of you who have ever taught, did you ever wonder if whether or not these people out there in the public had kids, dumped them off on your doorstep when they were 6 years old, wanted to pick them up 12 years later and they'd be educated, well-behaved, and godly as well? Didn't you sometimes feel like, oh, it's an impossible task? But, you know, I digress there. Now, also in this incident of the Ten Commandments, which is an extraordinarily important story because the Ten Commandments are the basis of this of the Mosaic law and Hebrew culture for generations and centuries to come. In verse 9 of the same chapter, the narrator continues, "Write them on the door frames of your homes and own your gates." Now he said, tell them to your children, and now write these commandments on your door frames and your gates. Of course, at the time the Ten Commandments were given, were the Jews living in homes? Did they have a picket fence around their yards? No, they're still out there in that wandering experience. Now, if you accept Moses as a historical figure, and the author of the first five books of the Old Testament, the so-called Pentateuch, which language is he using to write these down? Okay, let me give you this. Rabbinical Judaism calculates the life of Moses from 1391 to 1271 BCE. That's long before the Hebrews have a written language. Now, we're all familiar with the story of Moses. He is the greatest prophet. The prophetic tradition in so many ways from Moses to John the Baptist, isn't it? All of that period. So he's an extraordinarily important character. What are the basic facts of his life? Born a Hebrew, Egypt, slavery. At the time of his birth, there was a decree in the land, was there not? Kill the male children of the Hebrews. So a loving mother did what? Hit him. Hit him where? In the bulrushes, in a basket. His sister watching him. But who came along? Some Egyptian slave? The Pharaoh's daughter. raised as a noble Egyptian, then perhaps Moses could read hieroglyphics. It never says that in the Bible. What point is I'm trying to drive home here is, what is the language he was to write this down in? And sometimes the literalness was, you know, what is often attributed to a writer, even today with best-selling authors, is rarely produced by them. He merely coordinates his team if he's successful enough. But we see that. Now, of course, when Moses got back down from the mountain carrying the original Ten Commandments on the fronts and backs of the two stones he had, what did he encounter? What incident? They were worshiping an idol. I mean, these Israelites could fall away pretty quickly. I mean, it didn't take much, apparently, or they could go from being in good graces to being out of grace rather quickly. Well, he throws us down. They are destroyed. He's so distraught. Well, then they have to be redone. God tells them to do what? To chisel out two more stones to come back up. And the point I want to make here is that, did Moses actually write the Ten Commandments? No, they are composed by God. He did not write them in the sense of chiseling them into the stone, did he? What does the Bible tell us? Chapter 9, verse 10, Moses said, "The Lord gave me two stone tablets inscribed by the finger of God." Inscribed by the finger of God. "On them were all the commandments the Lord proclaimed to you." And furthermore, they were put this time in a wooden box. Now,
for you who's reading about this, I've always asked myself that question, particularly younger, I was always somewhat, not sure I even asked the question of language. You might say,
I don't know what language they were written in. And I'll say a couple more things and then we'll leave it here and save the beginning of the rest of the story until next week. The Bible is often very vague, isn't it? Many rabbinical teachers as well as Christian teachers based upon what is in the Bible, contend that the language of creation is Hebrew. And, of course, there is the Tower of Babel story, in which the Bible tells us that in the beginning there was only one language. Now, is that literally true? I don't know. Does it have to be literally true to be valid to us? I don't think so. I know it's sensitive to say you should question everything, but I've shared this with you before. I was trained to question. I don't think you're being irreverent to question. That doesn't mean you can wander off too far afield or anything like that. But so much of the Bible is symbolic. Does symbolism have meaning? You can't, you know, you can't literally accept everything literally. I think sometimes. Does it matter exactly what language? In the end analysis, God gave sacred laws. Whether Moses could read or write himself, or what language he might be, is not as important as the character of God, his forgiveness at times, and the law that he gave that became the cornerstone of the Hebrew tradition. Okay, I pretty much exhausted my time, I guess. Any questions or comments? Thank you.